Good morning. Good morning and welcome to the latest edition of One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me in the studio is...
Hala Goris. Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners.
And we do have some announcements, so as usual, I'm going to ask you to have a pencil or a pen and some paper ready to find out about some very important events coming up. But this morning, and I should also mention, as I try to remember to mention at the beginning of each show, that we welcome your participation as well. If you'd like to call with questions for our special guest this morning, please give us a call at 503-231-8187. This is, of course, Community Radio, KBOO, Democratic Grassroots Community Radio. We want to hear your voices as well. That's 503-231-8187. Please keep your questions on our topic and to the point. With us this morning from his home in Tel Aviv, Israel, is Mr. Eitan Bronstein. Mr. Bronstein is an Israeli educator and activist who has come to focus his work on educating the Israeli public about Al-Aqba, the catastrophe, about the history of Palestinian dispossession, and all of this education aimed as being a key step towards reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians. He founded and now works with the Israeli organization Zokrot. Zokrot in Hebrew translates as remembering, or those who remember, a group that is focused on this public education project in Israel. Eitan Bronstein, thank you so much for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bronstein. This is Hala Goris. Will just mentioned An-Nakba, which, as you know, in Arabic means the catastrophe. Could you please tell our listeners how you explain this event and its significance to an Israeli audience?
Yeah, we simply say that this is the tragedy of the Palestinians when Israel, the state of Israel, was founded on the expense of most of the Palestinians living in this land. Most of them were expelled from here, about 700 to 800 people, 800,000 people, and most of their villages and towns were destroyed.
When you explain this to Israeli audiences, do you find that this is knowledge that they already possess?
Yeah, in a way, we as Israelis, we know it. We know this happened, but I would say it's kind of suppressed knowledge. It's somewhere there, but it's really suppressed. It's out of the discourse, of the curriculum in schools, in the public sphere, you know, the media and so on. So people know very little about it. People know something that happened, but don't really acknowledge it, and we don't learn about it, and even people who are living in, you know, in former villages, Palestinian villages, we know very, very little about it.
Eitan Bronstein, can you tell us about your own personal history, how you came to know about this what we might call the hidden history of Israel and the founding of Israel, and specifically how you discovered this history near your home on a kibbutz near the Green Line in northern Israel?
So it's not exactly northern Israel, it's the center of Israel today. I was raised, I came from Argentina when I was 5 years old, my family, and I was raised in a kibbutz named Bachan, and I, as a child, yeah, no, on the telephone. One second, please. I was raised in that kibbutz, and just nearby, a few kilometers from there, there was a fortress, a very beautiful place, remains of a fortress named Kakun. And I visited there, I think, hundreds of times when I was a child and grew up in a kibbutz. And only some 5 years ago, I always knew that it's a crusader fortress, and only about 5 years ago I discovered by the internet that it was a Palestinian village destroyed, occupied and destroyed in 1948. And this was a very personal experience for me to see that the place that I, you know, place of my childhood, I never knew, I never had any idea that it was a Palestinian village.
I want to mention that our guest this morning is going to be in Portland. If you want to find out more about the work of this organization, Zokrot, they're going to be speaking here in Portland April 1st at Reed College. That's at 6:30 in the evening, so mark your calendars. Reed College, April 1st, 6:30 p.m. And he, Eitan Bronstein, our guest this morning, is speaking with Mohammed Jaradat, who you've heard on this this program in the past. This is a part of a joint lecture tour that's been organized by Zokrot and the Bethlehem-based Badil Resource Center, which is a refugee rights center in the West Bank. And that's being co-sponsored by Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and by the American Friends Service Committee. Eitan Bronstein, maybe you could talk a little bit about a particular campaign called the Canadian Park Campaign that was part of the first work that was taken up by Zokrot.
Yeah, in fact, we began, Zokrot began in that place named the Canada Park today in Israel since the 70s, after the expulsion of three villages, Yalu, Emuaf, and Beit Nuba, in Latrun area, just in the middle of the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. These three villages were expelled and destroyed in the 1967 war. And in the 70s, early 70s, the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, raised $15 million Canadian, and they founded a park named Canada Park after the Canada, you know, Jews from Toronto contributed the money. And this park is a recreational place, very beautiful. Thousands of trees were planted there on the ruins of those villages. And there are still many remains of the villages, but even though the remains are there, clearly there, the signs, many signs put up in the park to tell the history or the geography of the place is reminding only, you know, other histories, like Jewish history, Roman history around the Byzantine, Ottoman, and nothing about hundreds of years of Palestinian civilization there in villages. And we visited there many times, and we did a big event commemorating 36 years of occupation some 4 years ago. And we posted signs there indicating the cemetery of the villages and other sites of those villages. And the JNF people removed those signs. Then we addressed them, asking them to post signs. We told them that we are willing to post a sign to cover the cost and everything, and they said, no, we don't deal with political issues. Please address the relevant authorities. And then we addressed really the civil administration of the occupation territories, because it's beyond the green line, this part, though many Israelis don't even know that it's beyond the green line, because the road number one in Israel connecting Tel Aviv and Jerusalem is passing by there, 1 kilometer beyond the green line. But Israelis don't know even this. Now, we asked them to post the signs from the civil administration in the area, and only after more than 1 year that they didn't answer us, we submitted a petition to the Supreme Court, and they forced, in a way, the JNF and the civil administration to put up those signs, and they put up two signs with which indicate that existence of the villages there, the Palestinian villages. 2 weeks later, one of the signs was removed, you know, out of the ground, and the other sign was painted, but only in black, thick black paint that only covered the lines indicating the existence of Palestinian villages there. And after a while, it was totally removed, this sign. But we saw it, we found it, of course, as a very important achievement for us, because we forced the JNF to acknowledge the existence of those villages that was ignored until then. And then we asked them, the JNF, to do the same thing in many other sites that the JNF is responsible, and to post signs in tens of parks and forests that they are running in Israel. And recently they told us that they agree to change all their signs to tell something about history of the area of the park, the specific park, in order to include in those, in this, in their language, you know, the names of the villages existing in this area. So we see it as an important change. Of course, it's some symbolic, small symbolic issue, but I think I see it as very important as well.
Itan, it's a very important symbolic issue, although in light of the 530-some Palestinian villages that were destroyed, we're basically taking baby steps in terms of trying to get recognition for what happened to the Palestinians during a Nakba. You have written in the past that acknowledging the past is the first step in taking responsibility for its consequences. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we as Israelis, as I said in the beginning, we know very little about this history, and we must know in order to acknowledge the loss, the enormous loss of the Palestinians living here with us. Now, this acknowledgement is an essential step for any possible reconciliation in the future, because even though there will be perhaps some political, legal agreements between Israelis and Palestinians, there will never be a real reconciliation between the peoples unless Israelis acknowledge the enormous loss and the responsibility that we as Israelis bear for this catastrophe, for this Nakba. Now, this responsibility means many things. It's not only a declaration that we are responsible for a big part of it, not for all of it, but for a big part of it we are responsible. This means that we have to do many things. We have to post signs, we have to remap the land, we have to change the curriculum to study about this, and we have also, of course, to acknowledge the right of return of the Palestinian refugees to their homes. And all these are a necessary step in order to have some reconciliation in the future.
But doesn't acknowledging the right of return of Palestinians and their descendants, doesn't that pose an existential question to the state of Israel as a Jewish state?
Yes, of course. Of course. The existence of a Jewish state, which can never be a democratic state, of course, in the Middle East, is a big challenge for any possible peace in this place. And you know, Zionist thinkers throughout the history of Zionism knew it. The first one, I think, was Jabotinsky, that some 8 years ago he wrote that there will never be a peace, of course, with Palestinians here, and what we'll have to live is under what he called an iron wall, and we have to build an iron wall in order to fight forever with the Palestinians, because, of course, they are not going to accept a Jewish state here or a Jewish entity here. So, yes, we, of course, think that Jews in Israel have the right to live here and have a right to have a national, cultural, and other expressions, of course, speaking Hebrew, teaching our history, and so on. But a Jewish state, you know, that plays a sovereignty for Jews and only for Jews here, is a big problem for all of us if we want to live here and not to be only colonizers or occupiers of this land.
What kind of transition? I want to talk, of course, some more about your own history. In particular, I want to explore your beginnings of activism in terms of refusing to serve in Lebanon and the West Bank. But I want to stay on this point for a moment and get your sense, your vision of how Israel as a state could transition to becoming perhaps a genuine secular state, a state of its citizens, as opposed to a state of the for the Jewish people. What? How do you think about that future for Israel?
Yeah, it's a big question. unfortunately, we have don't have enough information, enough research for how to have this transition, and we at Zohrot, we try to think about it and to see how possible it is the return of refugees and resettling in the this country. And in general, you know, I can just say that we believe in one state, here, in one democratic, secular state on this land for all the Palestinians and Jews living here, and of course the refugees who were expelled and their descendants. Now, how exactly this transition will happen, of course it's a big, big question. Yes, but I hope that people like us and other activists or other people who try to change this reality can promote some, you know, activities and thinking and to make this happen or even imaginable today, which is still not even debated, you know, and I think this is a big problem for all of us.
And I need to remind our listeners that they're tuned to KBOO, community-sponsored radio here in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices. And with us, a very special guest from Tel Aviv, Israel, Mr. Eitan Bronstein of the organization, the Israeli organization, Zokrot. Zokrot is Hebrew, translates as remembering, or those who remember. And I also want to remind our listeners that they can call in if they have questions for our guests, 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. If you'd like to find out more about this organization, this Israeli organization, Zokrot, you can go to their website, which is www.Nakba in Hebrew, that's NakbainHebrew.org. That's Nakba in Hebrew. Along the right side of that page, you'll see that you can view the page in English, Arabic, or Hebrew. Just click on English or Arabic if you prefer to see the information in those languages. So that's another resource for you. Maybe we could turn back to your earlier history, Mr. Bronstein. As a young soldier, I assume, during the first Lebanon War, what moved you first to choose to, at that time, I think it was a very unusual move, to refuse to serve in Lebanon during the first Lebanon War?
Yeah, you know, I must tell you first that I was an excellent soldier. I'm not very proud today to tell it, but... Yes, I was raised in a kibbutz as a normal, if I can say, Israeli, common Israeli, and in as a kibbutz member, growing up in a kibbutz, I never questioned this issue of serving in the Israeli army. For me, it was obvious, and this was a way to serve my society, my country, I don't know, my people perhaps. I don't remember myself never as a very enthusiastic Zionist, but it was kind of obvious for me, you know, that this is what I should do. And then I was in the army 3 years, and I served in the occupied territories from the 1967, and I never questioned this issue of reserving there, though I had some experiences which I, of course, didn't like at all, but I never questioned it. And then, by the end of my service, began the 82, began the war in Lebanon, which I opposed it since the first second. And I must admit that me, like some others, leftist Israelis, we opposed it. You know, mainly I must admit it, mainly because, or not mainly, I think, but also due to the fact that the leader of Israel was Menachem Begin then. You know, I'm always keep asking myself, what would have happened if Yitzhak Rabin or Shimon Peres were the prime minister back then? I'm not sure the refusenik movement would even, you know, exist then. But anyway, it was Begin and Ariel Sharon who led Israel into this terrible war, an attack on Lebanon, and I opposed it in the first second, and then after I was I finished my 3 years, I was called up to the first reserve in the army. It was some 6 months after I was freed from the 3 year service, and then it was for me the first time to have this dilemma of this question, what should I do? Because it was, as you said, it was quite unusual yet that they were refusers to the, in the army, but there was already some debate about it, and there were some people already who refused, so it was, there was already some debate and some awareness to the possibility for me to refuse, but it was still very, very strange. As I said, I was an excellent soldier. I never thought about refusing. I was in a kind of elite unit, more or less, in the army. And but then, after many hesitations and talks with friends and people and my parents, and then I decided that I should not go there, and the best way to serve, you know, my society, my country, and my, is to refuse to go there, to Lebanon. And I was jailed for the first time for some, I think, 28 days. And it was, for me, it was the most important crisis until today. You know, I think I see it as, in my biography, as the most important crisis with my state, the state of Israel, in understanding that that not always being a good citizen doesn't mean that always I have to obey all its commands.
Hey, Tom, now might be a good time to take a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, this is Will, and I would like to thank the speaker for his very important work on for peace in the Middle East. I have a specific question, and that is, has anyone on either the Palestinian or the Israeli peace side considered the possibility of having a regime of right of return which was totally equivalent? In other words, for every Jew that is allowed to return to Israel today, there could be a Palestinian opposite number admitted as well. I'll be happy to take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand exactly the question.
The caller asked if a part of the agreement about the right of return, that has it ever been formulated in terms of for every Jew who returns to the land of Palestine, of Israel, there would be allowed a Palestinian to return to these same historic lands? That was the question from the caller. Has the question of the right of return ever been formulated in those terms?
Oh, look, today we have, of course, the lowest return for Jews. And as I see it, in my opinion, we should, of course, change this law and include Palestinian refugees and give, you know, high priority to first return of Palestinian refugees. And then, as I see it, if there are, of course, Israeli Jews living here with Palestinians, I see also a possibility or kind of priority for Jews in the world to immigrate to this shared state. I don't know if this answers the question.
Yeah, and I understood the caller a little bit differently. I thought the caller meant that for all of the Palestinians returning to Palestine/Israel, the Jews from Arab lands should be allowed to return in the same numerical number. I may have that incorrect, but it's a very interesting question indeed. You know, out of Iran, there has been a very small Jewish population there that the Israeli government has been attempting to woo with financial gains, etc., for many years, and the majority of that population chooses to stay there. Let's get back to what your organization does, because it is a fascinating enterprise that you have taken as a Jew in terms of moving on to reconciliation and advocating for the right of return, which seems to be the biggest problem in terms of dealing with peace between Israeli Jews and Palestinians, this right of return. I don't know if you know, Mr. Bronstein, Salman Abu Sitta is a Palestinian city planner who I think resides in London, and he had written a book that maps out how the right of return can be accomplished. That inside of the Green Line and outside of the Green Line, there is sufficient land for the accommodation of all Palestinians in the diaspora. And if not to the same exact villages from which they were expelled, but to nearby villages, etc. And then you have the issue of, for those who choose not to, appropriate compensation. If I could switch gears a little bit, can you talk to us about whether there is correlation between compensation received by Jews who were victims of Nazi Germany and whether we can look at compensation for Palestinians in the same light?
Yeah, but I think, first of all, compensating people is not the right of return. The right of return means that every refugee, it doesn't matter if it's a Palestinian or a Jew from Germany, has the right to choose whether to return to his place or nearby to his place if he's not there anymore, or to be compensated, or both. He can return but also be compensated for all the loss, of course, of the time and property and so on, or to be resettled in another place. But anyway, compensation alone, it doesn't mean, of course, right of return. The right of return means that every Palestinian refugee can choose what to do with his future about this. Now, of course, I know Salman Abu Sitta, and I read his plan, and, you know, the big problem that we have about it, that people talk about right of return. Most of the, you know, there have been, I don't know how many conferences, and we participated in different conferences on one state and on right of return and in international law and so on. And the problem, as I see it, the problem of the discourse about it, even among those who support, of course those conferences are supporting usually the right of the Palestinians to return, the problem is that they talk usually only about the right. And this discourse has, in our view, a big problem, because when you talk about rights, it's quite abstract, I would say, argument. And, of course, Jews in Israel would say there is no right, and they say, yes, there is a right, and Jews in Israel are afraid that this right means that we should, you know, swim to the sea, back to Europe or other places, and be expelled from our homes. Now, what we try to do is to, in a way, follow some Abu Sita's work and explore ways to implement the return, and in a way skipping the question of the rights and trying to see in which ways we can fulfill the return of refugees and resettle them in the territories which are today Israel or Palestine. And of course, Abu Sitta is right, and most of the land is empty, and most of the villages, the center of the built-up areas of most of the villages are empty. And it's not a question of space, of course. It's a question of ideology and of the essence of this entity here, you know, whether it's a Jewish state. So, of course, in a Jewish state, cannot be democracy, but if it's a democratic state, yes, of course, all people can live here together. And but as I said, we are planning now for June 2008 a conference in Tel Aviv for a Jewish audience. All our work, by the way, is targeted to the Jews in Israel. And although we are not only Jews in the organization, there are also Palestinians. But in this conference in Tel Aviv, what our aim is to show and to open possibilities and to present possibilities by different speakers, Jews, Palestinians, and others, of actual return. Not too much about the right of return, which this is accepted by us, and we don't want to discuss it anymore. We try to show, we want to show Israelis that return, actual return, doesn't mean, of course, expelling other people, because this is, I think, the big threat on Jews here, because, you know, we, in a way, return, though, of course, we cannot compare the return of the Jews to their land and the return of the Palestinians, I hope, in the future. But in a way, you know, the Zionist mythology says that we are returning to our homeland, and we established our own state, which we deserve to. And now, this return was at the expense of other people. So, as I said in the beginning, this knowledge is somehow suppressed, but is there. So we, as Israelis, many Israelis say, okay, if there, our return meant expulsion of so many people from this place, their return in the future means that we will have to go somewhere else or to be, I don't know, killed or many other threats. So we try to show, of course, that this is not the only possibility. There are many returns in the world today happening in, without expelling people, and of course, this is what we hope for our future.
And I want to return to that whole question of the right of return, but also, as you say, how that right of return could be realized. But I've got to inform our listeners that they're tuned to One Land, Many Voices, and you're also tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. And naturally, you can also listen as streaming audio at KBOO's website, www.kboo.fm. And our guest this morning is Eitan Bronstein of the Israeli organization Zokrot. He, along with Mohammed Jaradat, are going to be speaking here in Portland on April 1st. Again, get that pen and pencil and that pen and paper ready for the details on that. That's at Reed College at 6:30 p.m. on April 1st. And it's going to be an opportunity to engage with our guests some more and to hear different perspectives. Eitan, could you briefly talk about this lecture tour? How did Zokrot get together with Badil? And maybe you could talk a little bit about that Palestinian organization. How did you get together to organize this joint lecture tour?
Yeah, you know, it's I think it's really a nice story or history for in our beginning. You know, we began some 6 years ago to work at Zokrot, but Badil, of course, began some years earlier, of course. And just by the beginning of our work, we heard of this organization which published from Bethlehem a kind of refugees or right of return for the refugees, a packet or kit, you know, no, a packet in Hebrew. And this was amazing for us because usually, we know in Israel that the right of return and all this issue of the refugees is being dealt a lot in English and in Arabic, but suddenly to have an organization in the West Bank publishing something in Hebrew, of course targeting the Israelis in Israel, it was amazing for us. And we called them and we set up a meeting, and it was amazing the contact between us since the very beginning. We met Muhammad and Ingrid and other people there, and it was really amazing encounter. And they, in fact, their reaction to our ideas, because back then it was not really an organization, Zokrot, but we had only some ideas and some, you know, activists starting to think about it. But they encouraged us a lot, and they were very happy for our, you know, beginning, and said that it's an enormous step for Israelis. And I think this was, for me, you know, it's very promising, their reaction, because it shows that it shows something for our future together. You know, if their organization, Badil's organization, deals with the Palestinian refugees' rights, of course, mainly the right of return, and they establish the case, they explore the case of the return, and so on. And if they are working with us together, it means that the right of return of Palestinian refugees doesn't mean that we, as Jews living in Israel, have no place here. It's on the contrary. As we see it, we have to work together for it. And we, as, you know, for me, I want to tell you something very important. For me, as Israeli Jew, acknowledging the right of return and implementing the right of return, it's my possibility, and it's my my chance to live here, and really live here, and not as an occupier, as a soldier, as someone who has to raise up my kids, you know, as soldiers and so on. For me, it's very, very important. It's not only about the the rights of the Palestinian, which is important, of course, it's obvious, but it's also about my future living here in peace. And I think the cooperation with Badil, and I hope this speaking tour together will give a big push for all this future.
You know, it's wonderful hearing you talk about this in an optimistic tone, because many of us have become quite pessimistic. I was listening to your child in the background earlier in the interview, and I thought of my own child, Jacob Ya'ub, about how Eitan Bronstein's child and my Palestinian child can live together in peace in the same land. Let me switch gears then and get back to my pessimism, if I could. The Israel that I grew up in Nazareth was an Israel where I, as a Palestinian, knew from a very early age, as a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, that I was less than human, that I was the other, that I was a part of that society that did not belong, that was segregated, that was mistreated. Has Israeli society changed much since I left there at the age of 10? That many decades ago.
Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid not much. And I think you are very right. You know, for me, the big shock, I must tell you, talking about Nazareth, there was also in Nazareth happened those, you know, demonstrations and killing in October 2000. And you know, for me, as probably for many of my colleagues, not only at Zohot but in other organizations, this events of October 2000, when 13 Israeli Palestinian demonstrators were killed by police, by soldiers, was a big how can I say, of course a big shock, but it brought to our mind, at least I can say to my mind, that the problem is it's not about equality. You know, the problem is not that I have some more budget than you as Palestinian living in Nazareth. Of course this is true, that there is no equality, but the roots of it, it's much deeper, because if it's only a question of equality, I don't think people just, you know, or soldiers just shot and see as a threat when Palestinians are demonstrating. But acting like this, shooting demonstrators, enabled us to understand that there is a much, much deeper problem here. And in a way, yes, I'm. You know, it's hard to me listening to your experience, but yes, I must acknowledge it, that this is the truth. I think Palestinians here in Israel are, I don't know how to say it, but exactly, but of course they are not equal to us in any sense. Their language, their memory, their history, their everything, their life is not equal to us. So. And this is how this state was established. And if we establish a state on expulsion of other people, you know, and taking all of their rights and their land, most of the land being taken even after the Nakba, you know, much of the land of Palestinians remaining in Israel was confiscated after the creation of Israel. So all this is not just a question of simple equality, you know, like in between, I don't know, blacks and whites in the U.S. or... It's a very, very deep in the essence of the creation of this Jewish state. And I don't think it changed much until now. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up that the dispossession continues today, that it's still about house demolitions happening now, a wall being built around villages and towns. May I ask you about your campaign with respect to Tel Aviv University? Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, we one of the main activities that we are doing is we organize tours to destroy the Palestinian villages and sites and towns from 1948. You have to understand that in Israel, as you mentioned before, the hundreds of places been destroyed after 1948, after the Nakba, and some of them repopulated by Jews, not destroyed, but repopulated by Jews. Now, one of them is the village named Sheikh Mohannes, which the University of Tel Aviv is sitting more or less on the center of this former village. Only a small part today of the center of the village is still there, and the cemetery of the village is still there, but of course most of the village was destroyed. So we, some 3 years ago, we organized a tour for Palestinians and Jews, mostly Jews, to this place, to this village. And before the tour, we organized a kind of petition calling the president of the university, a very known professor, an Israeli delegate or representative, you know, in the talks, peace talks, what they call, mainly from with Syria, is a very famous professor for Syria, mainly, or the Middle East. His name is Itamar Rabinovich. And we addressed him by a letter asking him to indicate or to commemorate in the campus of his university the fact that there was a village there, which of course it's very known. It's no, nobody ignored it, and it's very known, you know, that people living around there, they know that it was Sheikh Mohannes. And we made, you know, we had hundreds of signatures by refugees of the village from different places, mainly in Jordan and some from Israel, and students and lecturers, you know, from the university and many other Israelis. And we addressed him, and he ignored, and he didn't do anything about it. They only said that in the future they are going to indicate somehow the existence of this village. But since then, we had many people approaching us and looking for information for this village. Many students are studying about it. There was a very, very, I would say, great, brilliant architecture work by one student that was a first prize in some competition for architectures, and she did some very interesting work about this, the memory of the village. And now we're on renewing the booklet that we published then. We are organizing or publishing a new booklet about Sheikh Mohannes, and we are going to have a tour just in some 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We're going to have again a tour to this village and to ask again the president of the university to commemorate this village.
I'm hoping that when you come to Portland, you will bring some of those booklets with you.
Just to remind our audience, you can still give us a call here if you'd like. If you have a question for our guest, it's 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Our guest, Eitan Bronstein of the Israeli organization Zokrot, and he, along with Mohammed Jaradat of the Bethlehem-based Badil Resource Center, will be speaking in Portland on April 1st, Tuesday evening, April 1st at 6:30 p.m., at Reed College. And now, we've taken up a lot of your time, Eitan. Can you stay with us a little longer? Because I know you hadn't planned on spending an entire hour with us this morning.
Yeah, okay, a few minutes more, it's okay.
Okay,
two minutes more, and then we'll fill up the rest of our time with some announcements.
I'm glad to hear that, because I want to talk to you about Bir al-Sab'ah. And we do have a caller, so before we talk about Bir al-Sab'ah, go ahead, caller.
I just wanted your audience to know that there is a website. It's called gopbias.org, George Oscar Paul Boy, I-A-S as in Sam, .org. And it has much of the of that early history that that your guest is talking about, that 1948. Now, I understand, what month is it that Israel is going to celebrate its 60th anniversary of becoming a state?
May.
In May. And when is this conference in Tel Aviv? Is that also in May?
Eitan?
Hello?
Eitan, is the conference in Tel Aviv in May also?
It will be just a short while afterwards. It will be in June, and together with publishing our third issue of a high-quality, beautiful magazine named Sedek.
Are you going to take part in any way questioning the legitimacy of that May 1948 founding of this controversial state that, as you said, and as that website, gopbias.org, states, much of, I think there was a program where demolition of villages, the expulsion of people. It seems to me that any so-called state that's founded on the principle of expelling the people who live there is questionable. And I'm just wondering, have you made any attempt to take part in that May so-called celebration?
Thank you, caller, for that question.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so look, it's been, I think, 4 years already that every evening of the Independence Day of Israel, the evening, the very evening of the celebrations, we at Zohrot, we organize a kind of a counter debate or activity, which criticizes, of course, the situation, you know, of being a Jewish state, a non-democratic state, and we do different activities, like lectures and other things in our place, and then by the night we go out to the streets and we do different things. You can see it in our website, some very, very interesting visuals from those activities. For example, one activity is we joined an organization named I Almost Forgot organization, and we, as I almost forgot, we went out the streets and had some bubbles, like it was kind of ad-busting activity, add bubbles to models and posters in the streets in advertisements, saying those bubbles, like, I almost forgot that Independence Day, the Israeli Independence Day, is the Nakba Day, and another, like, I almost forgot that Israel was founded upon the destruction of 531 villages and towns, and so on. And so we do, of course, challenge every Independence Day the basics, you know, of this Jewish state. In the next day, in the Independence Day, we join the march of return of the Palestinian displaced Israel, internal displaced Palestinians, and so yes, of course we challenge, but of course we are not going to join in any way the celebrations of Israel. So, but I want to tell you also something that you know, Israel, it's a whole year celebrating. Now it's the 60th anniversary of Israel, and you don't feel that people. I think if where we feel it is more in kind of you know, in satirical shows in television. There is no really kind of happiness or joys or I don't know big satisfaction in Israel for you know, for this state, and I think people are not. As we see it, we are not really celebrating. It's the future of this state, as we see it, is very vague, and I'm not talking about leftists, you know, people who oppose Zionism. Even ordinary Israelis, unfortunately, we don't see a future. And of course, because there is no future in this way, there is only a future of war.
I want to remind our listeners that you can go to the website www.nakbainhebrew.org. You can read it in English, Arabic, or Hebrew. Eitan Bronstein, thank you so much for joining us from Tel Aviv and for the wonderful work that you do. We look forward to seeing you in Portland.
Thank you very much, and I really hope to meet you there. Bye-bye.
We're looking forward to it. And we want to tell our listeners about some very important events coming up in the last few minutes. Of course, if you'd like to call in, we might be able to work in your call for a question for at least Hala and I, and maybe a comment as well. The number here is 503-231-8187. I do, of course, want to mention just once again that our guest this morning, Eitan Bronstein, and his colleague, Mohammed Jaradat of Badil, the Badil Resource Center, will be here in Portland at Reed College April 1st. That's a Tuesday evening at 6:30 p.m. The title of the program is Acknowledging the Past, Imagining the Future, Palestinians and Israelis on 1948 and the Right of Return. That again, April 1st, 6:30 p.m. at Reed College. I also want to mention that there are two very important events coming up. Hala, do you want to talk about the first one?
Sure. On March 14th, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and Portland Peaceful Response Coalition, along with...
March 15th.
Sorry, March 15th. I'm glad you corrected me, Will. So that is March 15th. AUPHR, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights and Portland Peaceful Response Coalition, along with many other local peace and social justice organizations, invite you to come out for a rally and march calling for an end to the U.S. occupation in Iraq, an action calling for the U.S. to bring the troops home now. This is a day of action which will include action tents, including one focused on a Nakba, an incredible collection of photographs from 1948, providing a vivid history of the events of 1948. There will also be an action tent focused on the Bush administration's assault on the Constitution and international law and on immigration rights, immigrant rights, sorry. Along with a youth action tent, GI resistance and support, the war and occupation in Afghanistan, and the threat of war on Iran, and much more. If you'd like to find out more, or if you'd like to volunteer to help, please call PPRC's voicemail line at 503-344-5078. That's March 15th, Saturday. Pretty much the morning throughout the afternoon, but the rally will start at 2 p.m. and the march at 2:30 p.m.
And that is at the South Park Blocks in downtown Portland. South Park Blocks, pretty much all day events calling for an end to the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq, and of course calling for an immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops. Bring them home now. And that's, again, March 15th, Saturday, March 15th. The rally starts at 2, the march at 2:30 p.m., but there's going to be lots of other great work happening at the South Park Blocks throughout the day. A second event that is marking this very tragic anniversary, this five-year mark of the U.S., since the U.S. launched this criminal war and occupation in Iraq, is on Wednesday, the following Wednesday, March 19th, and that's actually going from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. and then again from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Iraq for Iraqis now, U.S. out, 5 years of war and occupation. This is a day of action on the fifth anniversary of the invasion. And that's going to be at first at Terry Schrunk Plaza in downtown Portland from 11 to from 11 to 11:45 at Terry Schrunk Plaza, then at the World Trade Center from 12 until 12:45 p.m., to the old federal courthouse from 1 to 2 p.m., and then the evening action again at Terry Schrunk Plaza. And if you have any questions about that action, again, that's March 19th, Wednesday, March 19th. You can call Peace and Justice Works for more information. That's 503-236-3065.
And we've had another request for Eitan Bronstein's organization, Zokrot's website. It is www.nakba in Hebrew. NAKBAINHEBREW.org. And if you've missed any of our previous programs, or if you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand at www.pdxjustice.org. That's www.pdxjustice.org, where you'll also find links to other great videos and audio programming.
And, of course, we want to hear from you. If you'd like to write to us at One Land, Many Voices, you can write to us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. And I should also mention that we are now, One Land, Many Voices does have a page at KBOO. If you go to the KBOO website at www.kboo.fm, you can find the One Land, Many Voices programs page, web page. And that you'll find there many of our previous programs, and we'll try to update with the latest program.
Will, do we have time for one more caller?
I think certainly we have time for one more brief call.
Go ahead, caller.
Thank you. I'll make it brief. Will, it's Jeff in North Portland. I simply wanted to thank you for your leadership on so many of these important issues. It is you, Will, who stands down there at the plaza with the battery-powered megaphone and is making a real civil issue of an issue of our First Amendment rights in this country. And thank you for this program. You too, Hala, of course. But thank you, Will. Thank you, and press forward. And we're all rooting for what you're doing, and we're thankful for your leadership in this area.
You are too kind. You can. Hala will tell you that I'm blushing right now.
That he is, and I agree with everything you said, caller.
Thank you for taking my call. Bye-bye.
You bet. You know, our theme music is provided by the wonderful oud musician Rahim Al-Hajj. We open with Dances of the Palms, and our closing music is Yearning, both from the album Iraqi Music in a Time of War, available from Vox Lox Documentary Sound Art. Thank you.